6, and we're called to order the Military and Veterans of House Military and Veterans Affairs. We do have a quorum. With me is Representative Bob Lynn, Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, Representative Max Grunberg, and Representative Chris Tuck. We are here today to have a briefing by Brigadier General Leon Mike Bridges, the Adjutant General Acting Alaska. And as staff as well, General, if you could come to the chair and without further ado, begin your presentation, please. And for the committee's information, I've asked the General to complete his presentation and all questions will be at the end rather than interrupting the General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Brigadier General Leon M. Mike Bridges, acting the Adjutant General for Alaska and Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. What I would like to do today, and please bear with me, I've not done this before other than in a previous volunteer commission role. We've created an updated Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs 101 presentation with a bit more depth than has been in the past for certain public presentations. You all should have a printed copy of that for your use now and later. And then what I'm going to do is kind of a little mix of match of the slide set. I'm not going to go into detail on the slides because there's a lot of bar charts and such. But what I would like to present to you is the current critical mission components of the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, which is our divisions, the uniformed as well as the civilian side, with a little bit of where we've just been recently, what we're doing this year going forward, and then towards the end, question and answers, obviously, please let me have them. So anyway, our department is consists of nearly 4,300 personnel. The majority of those, of course, are the uniform components of the Alaska Army and Air National Guard, respectively. We also have a small Alaska State Militia, which is the Alaska State Defense Force, purely volunteers. They buy their own uniforms, but they're an additional little bit of reach back depth for the governor and the state to use in the event the National Guard of Alaska is very busy. But we use them as great teammates for certain tasks that help us with homeland emergency response preparation and response to emergencies. The agenda that I'll use here is we'll talk a little bit about the dual mission of the National Guard as well as our resourcing, the majority of which comes from the federal government and Department of Defense. We'll talk about the department or Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, the Alaska Military Youth Academy, AMIA for short, the Office of Veterans Affairs, Alaska Aerospace, just in the last several days with the governor's office. I'm really going to put that to the side at the governor's request. And as we've been talking to some of you today and yesterday, Craig Campbell, the president and CEO of AAC, will do a separate presentation to talk more specifically about AAC now. This is what our organization chart looks like with the commissioner, dual-hatted, the adjutant general's the traditional title, who serves as the commissioner of our department. We have the deputy commissioner, which next to me here is Mr. Michael O'Hare. We have the federal agent of the Department of Defense, the red box, which is the USPNFO, the United States Property and Fiscal Officer, who is the chief of the National Guard Bureau, federal Title 10, agent to make sure that the state is using federal resources correctly, whether it's property, equipment, or funds. And then off to the side there, of course, Alaska Aerospace. Within our department, our primary components are the Army National Guard, which consists of approximately 1,900 soldiers, the Alaska Air National Guard, which is a bit over 2,100 currently assigned, the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division, which is the state civilian teammates who help train our communities in the event of a disaster so that when one happens, and they do here all the time, they are better prepared to respond locally first and then do the progressive build as necessary up to state and federal resources. We have the Alaska Military Youth Academy. Now, that is not a statutory core component of our department, but it has been in existence for 20 years. Congress stood this up because they considered the failure of young people in America to become such a severe burden it became a national security threat. So they funded, partially under federal funds, a program. 36 states have one of these. It's a military-based training program to redirect youth that are high school age to get back on track to a GED, high school diploma, and become productive citizens versus a burden on the rest of our society. Our program, this is its 20th year, and I'll talk about it a bit more later. And then we have a Veterans Affairs Office. It's not a division, and that's headed up by Mr. Verdi Bowen. His job in that team is to be the state channel or liaison for all of Alaskans, 77,000-plus veterans, to link them with the Federal Veterans Affairs Department programs and benefits that they may be due from their military service. And a very tiny office has been very successful at adding to the veterans that are registered in Alaska with the VA. We still have 44,000 more of them that we know are out there to get registered for any potential VA benefits. And these guys and gals have been very successful at adding to the list. We're over 34,000 now and climbing. Dual mission force, this is where the National Guard, under the federal constitution, the state constitution, we're dual-hatted and we live two lives every day. All of our folks, again, especially under an era of volunteer Army and Air Force, there's no draft, they have to want to serve. There is no obligated service in the United States citizenship roles today. Our federal mission is to prepare and fight wars. Army and Air Force, in our case, there's not a Marine Corps Guard, there's not a Navy Guard, it's the Army Guard and the Air Guard. The majority of our resourcing, equipment, funding, and training is federal resourced and federal directed for that mission set. But because we belong in the state constitution and the federal constitution as the militia, the governor is our commander-in-chief when we're not mobilized under federal Title 10 orders. So the governor of the state has a military first response force if and how he chooses to use it for homeland emergency response, preparation, and or other appropriate activities that are allowed by statute, regulation, and policy. This is the partnership and relationship with the federal and the state side. We have two commanders in chief. We take two oaths. We take one to the president as the commander in chief of the federal side of us and to the national constitution. We take a simultaneous oath by name to our governor as our state commander-in-chief and our state constitution. Every state and all the territories plus the District of Columbia have an adjutant general who serves as the commander of those components. The majority are dual-hatted with a military and veterans affairs type component, not just the uniform part of their state. Big states, some of them have a commissioner for homeland emergency response, and then their adjutant general purely manages their National Guard. And then you have the units underneath that. We're everywhere. The Guard is hometown America, and the language and the reality is, if America didn't have its hometown National Guard, the federal military forces would be very separated from its citizens that it's there to protect. So the National Guard is a linkage all the time because we're military and we're a hometown response force for our states and our communities. Beyond the global war on terror, as many of you know and have been paying attention the last since 9/11/2001, we have been a very engaged National Guard in our military missions across the globe. We were before in training missions and exercises, but we have been a deployed force now since 2001, unlike in the history of the National Guard or our nation. World War II, people signed up for the duration plus 6 months. But we've been at war, direct conflict now, one way or another, for 13-plus years. Your Alaska National Guard is no different than all the rest, and our folks are veterans. We still have new, brand-new enlistments off the street. They're coming to serve, and the first thing they say is, when can I deploy? And that is happening every time we bring one in, Army or Air Guard. We're approximately 50% prior active duty in the Alaska National Guard, between the Army and the Air Force. So a huge amount of our folks have active duty experience from the Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marines. They come to stay home in Alaska, and they want to continue to serve, but in a part-time role, so they join your National Guard. Domestic operations, this is where we have the build. Some states' governors like to send in the Guard because they like to see that uniform presence to calm the population in the event of a massive blizzard like's going on in the Northeast right now. Our state has this correct, which is where local first, regional, state, federal is needed, and sometimes parallel activities depending on the extent of an emergency. But the local leaders are in charge. When the governor says, I need the guard to go do something, we support the local leadership. We do not take charge unless everybody else is completely incapacitated, and it's purely long enough for local governance to take charge again, and we give them back the keys. But we don't want them. We want to support the local leadership or the state civilian leadership. We are also the conduit to federal Title X military resources, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, FEMA, and other federal capabilities through our Department of Homeland Security Emergency Management and our military components. If we need some extra trucks, I can call the garrison commander at Fort Wainwright or at J-Bear and say, I need some extra Army trucks, but I've got the drivers. Or send your drivers, but they're going to work for us in our state capacity and support the governor. So we have those linkages and those relationships that are there all the time to help us if we really have to ramp up an emergency response. And that's ground equipment, that's aircraft, the whole works. And having us there as the uniform component gives a much quicker access to those resources. Your Alaska Air National Guard's two wings. We have the 168th Wing, which is based out of Eielson Air Force Base up near North Pole. And it has a subordinate unit at Clear Air Force Station, which is a space and early warning detection unit to look for incoming ICBMs and so forth. It sees everything that's in outer space over our part of the planet. The 168th Tanker Wing is the Pacific Theater Commander's primary air refueling capability. They're an operational unit, as is the space unit, and they're 24/7, 365. Over half of the personnel there are full-time National Guard members. All of the people at Clear Air Force Station are full-time National Guard members. Primarily, they have the tankers. They have the 176th Wing, which is the most complex and biggest wing in the Air Guard nationwide, has C-17s, which are the large cargo jets, C-130 aircraft, which are the rotary wing, prop-driven, smaller cargo aircraft. We have the Rescue Coordination Center for the state of Alaska. We have the C-130 HC models, the HH-60 Pavehawk rescue helicopters. Those are the ones that do the combat search and rescue mission on deployed missions, but they do it in real life here in Alaska as well to protect our citizens when they get in trouble. Those folks just deployed yesterday and a month ago. So most of the pararescue unit is deployed overseas as we speak. And then we have the Air Defense Squadron, which helps scramble and manage and support the North American aerospace defense of the sovereignty of North America. That's the jets against the bombers sort of thing. Your Alaska Air National Guard is that Air Defense Squadron in Alaska. Here's what they've been doing. The Air Guard deploys differently than the Army. The Air Force units, the Air Guard units, typically go anywhere from 30 days to 6 months when they go and deploy someplace, sometimes up to 9 months. They're typically a much faster turn. They'll come and go two or three times, sometimes in 1 or 2 years, depending on the unit and the mission set. They self-deploy with their own aircrafts and take them with them, and then they do the mission for a theater commander somewhere around the world. 24/7 is the air defense mission. The rescue forces, as I mentioned, they're mostly deployed right now, so the Army Guard's going to pick up the helicopter support to those guys, but some of their personnel, the pararescue PJs, will ride on Army Guard helicopters now if our state trooper helicopters or civilian local responders aren't able to help. So we back each other up there. The Clear Air Force Station mission, as I mentioned, that's a national strategic security mission. That's in association with the Army Guard's 49th Ground Based Missile Defense Battalion at Fort Greely, which I'll talk about a bit more later. The C-17s, those are the cargo jet of the current and future for the U.S. Air Force. The big C-5 aircraft fleet is nearly retired. The C-41 fleet is completely retired. C-130s are becoming aged. Our particular batch of aircraft with our wing are part of that, and they will be going away over the next couple of years. The good news out of that is because we're operationally deployed here in Alaska, we will be trading those for ownership of a C-17 fleet. So we'll be taking and retiring the old aircrafts and picking up the modern C-17s. That's our next 30 to 50-year mission set and aircraft. There will be some growth to your Alaska Air National Guard with that as well. Alaska Army National Guard, approximately 1,900 members, Joint Forces Headquarters, which is just a bit over 100. That's the command group and the primary senior staff. The 297th Battlefield Surveillance Brigade is going away. The three chiefs of staff of the Army ago said, I need nine of these. Alaska was assigned one of them. The current chief of staff of the Army says, I don't need any of these, so he's terminated all of them, and ours will be gone within the next year and a half. That'll be about 760 of our manpower spaces, plus equipment capabilities and so forth that we stood up, and they were available to the Army this last year during their ready year. We're still fighting with the National Guard Bureau and the active Army as to what that's going to be replaced with. We have some pieces, but the overall drawdown with the Army drawdown, we will be giving back 150 spaces, give or take, to big Army to pay their downsizing bill. That's our share. We're working on the appropriate headquarters and appropriate dual capable structure to offset that, and that's network signal. That is rolling stock engineers to do road clearing and that sort of work, and a brigade headquarters that's worldwide deployable to give folks a place to go. Right now they're looking at replacing our cavalry squadron with a light infantry battalion, which has disadvantages for Alaska, comes with almost no equipment, and that affects our full-time manning. It affects our capability to bring equipment to a homeland security mission if we need to respond quickly. So we're still in negotiations with the Army and National Guard Bureau on the Army Guard's force structure going forward. Within our 38th Troop Command, that's our Aviation Battalion, our Black Hawk Helicopter Fleet, our MP Battalion, Military Police, that's being downsized. We're going to keep an MP company, but the headquarters is going away, and we will likely be getting some offset with a useful unit for that too. Our civil support team is in Guam as we speak, doing a Guam island-wide emergency response exercise as their trainer evaluators, and it's a great partnership with one of our Pacific Theater teams and organizations. That's the weapons of mass destruction, hazardous materials release response unit. We have our training regiment, which is our officer and enlisted training academy. And then we have the standalone, unique national security mission, the 49th Ground Base Missile Defense Battalion at Fort Greely. That's 210 personnel. They're all full-time National Guard members. And that's part of our national security strategy. And as many of you have been paying attention, Fort Greely is due for some mega-billion-dollar upgrades with the missile systems up there, as well as the infrastructure to house and potentially launch those missiles when needed. So Fort Greely is still very busy. And we see nothing but growth in the additional resources going into there for that national mission. Here's what we've been doing. Our big unit deployments are gone. We only have two Army Guardsmen currently deployed there in Afghanistan, along with our Mongolian Partnership Unit as our state partnership program country. And other than that, the U.S. Army Pacific, the Pacific Theater Commander, other commanders in the lower 48 and in Europe are asking for our units to go and do training rotations with them, exercises and so forth, and that's what we're going to use to offset the lack of combat or equivalent deployments for our folks so that they get to do some away games and training, see some different terrain, work with other units, and continue to serve as traditional National Guard forces. We give the governor some very quick ground resources and rotary wing helicopter capabilities in the event of a local emergency. This recent summer, our state had the unfortunate opportunity to kick off the biggest fire in the nation at one time, and we were able to put our Black Hawk helicopters with the water buckets in to assist with the local responders on that. That was our biggest ground or Army Guard emergency response of note recently. PACOM, Pacific Command, that's the Air Force, Navy, Marines, and active duty in the entire Pacific Theater. We are actively nested mission-wise with those folks, and that includes Korea and anywhere in the Pacific Rim because of some of our capabilities and some of their shortfalls with active duty units. And the Battlefield Surveillance Brigade, until it goes away, is aligned with First Corps. If you watch MASH, they call it I-Corps, but First Corps based out of Fort Lewis, Washington, and Korea. So we do have a partnership and a real mission with those folks. Going to the civilian side of our department, the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, that is our civilian team to help prepare local communities and our statewide emergency responders in an organized manner to be prepared for and then respond to a catastrophic disaster of whatever level. And part of that includes infrastructure evaluations. Part of that includes equipment to respond to be able to communicate if all of our traditional communication systems are broken or fall down. Coordinated effort, multi-agencies, civilian volunteer agencies such as Red Cross, Samaritan's Purse, and those sort of things. All of this is coordinated, organized, and managed through our DHSEM and their ongoing relationships and partnerships with all the folks that are involved in that. Local emergency planning committees are key to a lot of our hub communities around the state. They link into the State Emergency Response Commission for a coordinated effort with a purely civilian face on emergency response. Partnership for Infrastructure Protection, as I mentioned, this is for critical infrastructure that supports life, economic activity, public safety, and public health, and the assessment of the potential damage, how can that damage be mitigated on that infrastructure. If the Port of Anchorage were wiped out, we know what that would have effect on economic-wise, let alone life and safety with Alaska, so how would we recover from that and get it operating and take care of Alaska's needs? Power plants, water systems, public health, the whole works. We have been an active participant in exercises to stress those partnerships and what we as Alaskans would do first to support ourselves in the event of an emergency. 2012, the day I took command of the Army National Guard, upstairs in the Armory, down in the State Emergency Operations Center, we were told we need the guard to go to Cordova and shovel snow. So literally, the time I was taking command of the Army Guard, within 24 hours, I had troops traveling on Alaska Military Youth Academy buses through the Whittier Tunnel onto an Alaska State Ferry with a contract crew of heavy equipment operators and taking the ferry in the blizzard over to Cordova to start clearing the snow off the hospital, the school, the library, etc. And that was what the 2012 cold weather event, which our fellow states in the Pacific or in the northeast part of the nation are going through right now. They put their uniformed guard members on the street quick because of the level of the emergency. Vigilant Guard, we commemorated the 50th anniversary of the 1964 Alaska earthquake and tsunamis, and we brought in 5,000 people either locally or playing long distance digitally, 10,000, sorry, to replicate a massive catastrophic earthquake with tsunami that included the complete devastation of the Port of Anchorage, airports going down all over the place, the highway being broken, you name it. And we brought in all those interagency partners, active duty, all military components. We brought in a fleet of Army ships. We brought in Navy ships. The Air Force came in spades. FEMA, Red Cross, you name it. We reopened the Port of Anchorage in 72 hours using a military system that we even brought in the fuel systems to pump fuel up inland so that we could keep moving the trucks on the ground and refueling the airplanes and keep supplies and equipment going. We opened up a field hospital to replicate taking care of mass casualties. First time this thing has been ever exercised in Alaska, and we proved the concept with that. Our next one is a cyber attack of catastrophic nature, and that we're going to be active participants in with Alaska, the Alaska National Guard, FEMA, Department of Defense in 2016. So everybody who thinks their cell phones are a magic thing, there's going to be some effects in real life when those things are attacked. We're going to do what we can to be prepared for that. The Alaska Military Youth Academy, this is its 20th year, as I mentioned, in existence. We've graduated, we're about to graduate now nearly 4,500 cadets from that program. That's where we take the 16 to 18-year-old kids who are falling out of high school or have just fallen out of high school, put them in a military training regimen for physical fitness, personal self-discipline, and motivation. Heavy components on basic education, citizenship, and public service to give them a chance to reboot, go for a GED, a high school diploma through our program, return to their traditional school and gain a high school diploma, and get them into the workforce, college, a VOTEC program, or something productive in their lives going forward. They also have to do a large component, actual hours, hands-on time on the ground doing public service. And that can be doing color details, appropriate ceremonies and presentations, working at the food banks, cleaning up park strips and those sort of things. So they're in the community, in their uniforms, doing that public service component. We do two classes per year. This cycle, we're down a few kids, but we try and do 144 graduates per course. Veterans Affairs, very small handful of people, as I mentioned, are attending to and working to attend to the needs of all 77,000 veterans in Alaska so that they're registered with federal VA, and if they have an earned benefit, they have direct access to that, and the state is that linkage and liaison, especially with Alaskans, that some of them have an attitude, especially our Vietnam era or Vietnam veterans. A lot of folks came to Alaska, and they kind of wanted to go off the grid. We're finding a whole lot of those folks now because of our outreach programs as we travel around the state and do veteran town halls and so forth. That's where we're finding a lot of these folks who just said, I didn't do anything to earn this. If they didn't go to combat or if they weren't wounded, we have a lot of folks who believe that they don't deserve to be a VA veteran registry. And we're showing them, you know, that's not correct, and here's what this means to you and potentially your family. And our current team there has been absolutely brilliant and has really brought our Veterans Affairs program to the forefront. We just received a three-year, three-quarters of $1 million grant because of their work for our, what do they call them, really remote or really rural veterans. Pardon me. It's a transportation grant to get those folks that are on a road network of some sort to their veteran care. This is a brand new thing for Alaska. We're one of the first states to get this, and we got way more than kind of the average demographic of it. So this will benefit our veterans who don't necessarily have the money or the means to get to their care on a regular basis that they've earned and that we know that they're due. So we're really proud of that effort because it's paid off for Alaska's veterans. Alaska Aerospace, as I mentioned, it's a separately owned corporation of the state of Alaska. I'm not going to cover it in any further detail at this point unless you have a question I can try and answer in a little bit. All right. This is the stuff that's been in the media the last several months. It has shaken us to our core. A handful of folks joined our ranks while we were deploying. They came to us from active duty, which is doubly unfortunate, and a few of them prove that they're predators. And over time, some folks who could have and should have done something about that did not do so sufficiently, and some of our folks paid a dear price for that. But this is what we call an insider attack. This is not just unique to the Alaska National Guard. It's a DOD-wide issue. Prior to 3 years ago, Department of Defense, the training for sexual assault prevention and response, every soldier, airman, marine, etc., kind of got a PowerPoint briefing about once a year. There was no real method or sustained effort of any depth to train, educate our entire force how to prevent, intervene, and respond to a sexual assault of any kind. The Department of Defense definition of sexual assault is this wide. Civilian law enforcement's definition to be able to take and prosecute a sex assault is a much narrower definition. And that confused a lot of people along the way as well. We now have, in the Alaska National Guard, a very strong, very competent, and very well thought of nationwide amongst their peer groups, the other states, Sexual Assault Response Coordination Office, Prevention Program, Training Program, Victim Advocate Program, and capabilities of interagency with STAR, with other agencies in Alaska who help respond to sexual assaults. That includes direct and specific coordination with law enforcement. We have never had that before. It's been informal, it's been by coincidence, and we now have a very structured program that we can all be proud of, and I'm definitely very proud of. We now have people coming to our team because of the education, training, and proof over the last couple of years. That's where I'm going. Who somewhere in their past, whether as a child, a college student in the civilian sector, prior active duty experience, who says, I was sexually assaulted, they're coming to our team now and saying, I would like help. So this isn't just for new things within our ranks. This is for folks who are in the Guard now or other service components here in Alaska, that they trust our team now so much that they're coming to us for assistance. I had two of them again this weekend. Nothing to do with the Guard, except now these people are in the Alaska National Guard. In one case, it was a prior active duty incident, and the other one was a person who was at basic training a couple of years ago, and they've come forward now to say, this happened to me at basic training, I would like help. There are still more, we know that. But the point is, and what's important is, people are willing to come forward and ask for assistance now to deal with things that happened to them in their past from their other lives. And they're using our program and our team to help with that recovery. The other areas of concern in that report, command climate, lack of transparency in promotions, reprisal, and so forth. Every one of those is complex in its own way. But over the last several months, we've had teams of experts from National Guard Bureau and other states who've come in and help us get the foundation of a couple of things up and running. One of those is equal employment opportunity. Typically run under our human resources office, we have never had an established equal employment opportunity program of any note. There would be singular pieces in some units, but there was never a coordinated office of management for that. In the meantime, we've now hired a new full-time equal employment manager and a deputy, and we've trained almost 40 new equal employment advisors or liaisons within our ranks just over the last 3 months. We are in the process of ongoing education and training of every member of the Alaska National Guard, including the civilian side of our department, because we have the same sort of things going on with our civilian workforce. I call it frat house shenanigans or locker room shenanigans. It's inappropriate in the workplace. It can be bullying, hazing, sexual harassment. It matters not. It's still an insider attack, and it's wrong. We have changed our full-time manning resources to address this by putting professionals in there, training them, and vetting them before we put them in those positions to make sure the right folks are in these jobs. That has been a problem in the past. People have been put in those positions because they happen to be available, but not because they had the heart or the education or the demeanor to be an equal employment advisor or liaison or a sexual assault victim advocate. So we are diving deeper in every one of those selections before we allow somebody to be one of those special position assignments. One of the headlines in the report was potential for fraud. We just last month received the final out brief from a special assessment office of internal review and audit from National Guard Bureau. And the main area of concern there ultimately was in our partnership with our federal funds for facilities maintenance and management and our state facilities management division. Federal money is the primary source of our facilities maintenance funds, maintenance, construction, and so forth. We use state of Alaska employees in our department essentially as contractors to do that work on behalf of the Army National Guard and Air National Guard facilities. Over the last several years, that's managed through a master cooperative agreement with several annexes. Over the last several years, that became imbalanced where the state took charge of the use of those federal funds, to the contradiction of the guidance, rules, restrictions of the use of those federal funds. We're rebalancing that specifically based on the findings of that investigation and audit to get it where it's an even partnership, but we must meet the federal obligations absolutely as well as the state obligations to manage those funds, those resources, and where those employees work and the work they do, and how it's reimbursed between the federal government and the state government. The help from that team was tremendous. They gave us clarity of that. We're still doing internal reviews of some pieces of those annexes and appendixes, but they're finally in the open where we'll get that thing leveled out in coordination with National Guard Bureau and our state budget team. The command climate. Let's see. Starting out with the command climate, one of the upfront findings was a simple thing called an open door policy. That's where any member of the department can go to the senior leadership without fear of reprisal or retribution to say, I think I saw something wrong happen, or I think I've been badly handled by my boss. We found that the existing military format open door policy was a non-starter in the current era of communications, and people just didn't want to use it because it said you must go to your chain of command first. Sometimes their first level chain of command may be where they have a problem. So we took some of our kids, our junior enlisted, our junior officers, some of our civilian employees, and said, okay, Guard Bureau folks, called a couple of other states. We asked our inspector general to give us kind of a baseline. We said, now turn this into one for me to sign as the acting adjutant general for Alaska. So we let them tear at it, and they came back to us after a few weeks and gave us a new open door policy, which is now mine and which is our department's. And they're making use of it, and that's the whole point. They're not afraid to reach out now. They know that they can come straight to the top or any point in between to be heard, and that if a supervisor on the way comes in and says, you went to the general, I'm going to get you for that, either openly or subtly, they are protected because of that open door policy and the anti-reprisal policy that we put out along with it. Those are the key parts of the OCI findings and recommendations, and we had some very good, very helpful experts come in and help us do a baseline assessment and put together our program, because it's ours. It's the Alaska National Guard's programs. We have to own this. We brought in our junior members with our advisory teams in each of these functional areas. They've been doing a tremendous amount of work to help us get the future right with all of these lanes. We built these teams from the Army Guard, the Air Guard, some of our retirees, and our civilian teammates so that we have everybody, every cross-section of the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs represented. Because it's not just an Army problem, it's not just an Air problem, it's an all of us problem, but even more, it's an opportunity to do this right going forward. These are the areas, and you have all seen the OCI assessment that was given to the previous governor, and these are the primary areas that they were looking at. Application of military justice and the coordination with law enforcement. Let me talk about that a moment. This is one where to discipline an individual in the Guard, Army or Air, there's two primary paths and a third. The primary is the Army regulations on personnel discipline and the Air Force instruction on personnel discipline. Those are the federal tools that are always there and always have been. They're complex. We don't have a lot of legal advisors full-time to help manage those and use those processes for progressive discipline if somebody violates good order and discipline. But it's there, and it really does work. We have federal or civil law enforcement. If we have any indication or think, a guardsman has committed a crime, we're calling the cops. Local, state, whatever the appropriate level, the FBI, if it's on a federal military installation, we're calling CID, Criminal Investigation Division, on that base. This occurred on base, and it was a guardsman. This is the allegation. So we're doing the multi-party aspect if we even have an inkling of law, because we don't prosecute via law with the Alaska National Guard. I don't have that tool. We've never had that here in Alaska. We have an antiquated, built in 1955, territorial state military code that has no relevance in the modern era, it has no teeth, and it's never been resourced to be in effect in this state. I came from the Oregon Guard and the Washington Guard. We had a state military code in both. We used it primarily for when a soldier didn't come to drill. We'd have the police go and haul them to drill in handcuffs, and we would either put them to drill to work, or they'd get an Article 15 or a disciplinary action conducted with the state military code. Over the years, some states have had successful versions of that, others not so much. Ours is a not so much. We never implemented it here. Well, we probably ought to have one so that we have that capacity to prosecute via the military militia side of us under the state government and the state executive if none of those other things are sufficient or if there's reason for that as well. But even with that, and even with calling the cops and having a DA pursue a potential prosecution, because it's a federal uniformed military member, we're going to do a parallel action with the Army regulation or the Air Force instruction to penalize a miscreant on the military side. And that can be as little as a letter of concern, all the way to the most extreme, which is an other than honorable discharge. Dishonorable discharge if it was a federal Title 10 member. And all points in between. That's what we're doing with a lot of these folks who've made the media recently and have been part of the recent chaos and, oh my gosh, everybody's criminals in the guard. These cases are as difficult to prosecute via that as they are through civil court or through a state UCMJ. They cannot be talked about in the open because they're personnel administrative actions. They're protected by the Federal Privacy Act and so forth. And even upon conclusion, we are not allowed to say Sergeant Jones of the military police company received another than honorable discharge. All we can say is a generic statement, a mid-grade NCO of this brigade or of the Alaska National Guard was discharged because of law. We're not allowed to say any more details because we're a small organization, one, two, the Privacy Act, and small organization, people will immediately know, oh, Sergeant Smith of the MP company got thrown out and he lost all of his retirement and everything else because we're small. People know who did what. So we have to be very judicious based on legal guidance on what we can say happened to somebody. We can't lop heads off and do public executions. It just doesn't work. We also have stood up for the first time in our history a provost marshal's office. We've taken full-time resources that have never been done before. We've stood up, brought on active duty one of our majors who happens to be a law enforcement officer, and we're bringing in an Air Guard senior NCO who's a security forces NCO with our Air Guard, and we now have a provost marshal team. This is our liaison and coordination with law enforcement all the way up to the Attorney General's office. We've been building new memorandums of agreement with local law enforcement, with state law enforcement, and the Attorney General's office and the Department of Law as how to handle when somebody's in the guard, they've done something either in their civilian capacity, but they're still a guardsman, or if it's a guardsman while they're in uniform service, part-time or full-time, and they've done something to handle those cases in the proper manner with the proper law enforcement community or agency. We've never done this in Alaska's history before. But because of all the things that have gone on, we've taken and turned those resources and activated that. And it's already paying off. And I'll tell you right now, the latest one that's in the paper, the VPSO that tased or phasered a couple of kids, just found out today that's one of our part-time guardsmen. So if that case is proven, that guardsmen, even though they were acting in their civilian capacity, has a very likely chance of being dealt with in a disciplinary matter with an Army regulation because it's still inappropriate and he's still a sworn guardsman. So that's how we've turned these into new tools to handle these cases going forward. Kind of a timeline on what's been going on the last several months, where we're at today, and are we doing the right thing? That's going to be a feedback assessment from our troops, the people that serve with us, serve in our ranks, and the audience that we directly serve. Are we doing it right? That's where we're at. My command philosophy is the Adjutant General. And again, I'm the acting, but in the meantime, I'm responsible for all of this, is that we're a premier force driven by core values, empowered by trust, dignity, respect, ready and relevant for service to our state and our nation. This has been provided to every member of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, along with the key components of that message. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, General. I'm going to take the first couple of questions because obviously the biggest issue in front of the legislature is what you, at the end of your presentation. But I just want a smaller question. So turning to slide number 11, that's your Alaska Army National Guard. And, of course, it's been in the news that February 23 and February 24 is DOD will be in for listening sessions. Right. But what's interesting in listening to you is it's a lot of this you're already preparing for in case there is troop reduction.
Yes, sir.
Is it important? I'm stating the obvious. Is it important that those two communities, Anchorage and Fairbanks, come out and show how important the Army is and how it could be a benefit to the Alaska Army and National Guard?
Absolutely, sir. Excuse me. Fairbanks and Anchorage, either or, loses one of their brigade combat team. The economic impact, the available forces to respond into a state catastrophic emergency, our partnering as the Alaska National Guard with those active duty units to help train us to be better soldiers and airmen, and the capabilities we provide to them. We throw their guys out of our helicopters all the time, for an example, here in Alaska and overseas. The partnership between the Guard and the active Army and Air Force in Alaska in the last 10 years, because we've been going to war together, has never been better. And I've been here 30 years. There's always a rub between the active component and the Guard. It's just always there. It's a locker room, I'm tougher than you kind of thing. You're the part-timers, the weekend warriors. Because we've gone to war together and some of our folks have been wounded or died together on those deployments, it's a brother and sisterhood now unlike I've ever seen. We work and train together throughout the week, all year round. We're supporting U.S. Army Alaska missions, long-range international intel security communications things, 24/7 with Alaska Army Guardsmen. If one of those brigades goes, the economic impact to that immediate community and the state in total is not just the 5,302 soldiers that are in those brigades respectively. It's their families. It's the schools. It's the entire civilian business community surrounding and supporting them in the immediate vicinity. The longer wholesale level part of retail that supports those brigades on those posts and their families. The civilian employee force on those bases will be cut dramatically because they're there and exist to support those brigades. So it's just going to be a rolling massive effect at each of those communities and surrounding communities. Fort Richardson, Eagle River, Palmer, Wasilla, the entire Matsu Valley because they commute in. They don't all live on the base. Those folks stay in Alaska, many of them, when they finish their tour of duty, become Alaskan citizens long term. And if their brigades go away and they get shipped out somewhere else in the Army, we lose those folks and everything that they bring to us. Our part, yeah.
So, General, is the question that I'd like you to answer, it should be a really short answer. DOD has ordered you to prepare for the possible turn down of troops.
Right.
Thank you, sir. One other, then I'll go to the, excuse me, go ahead.
If I can have my deputy commissioner.
If you don't mind, please. Thank you. For the record, Michael O'Hare, acting deputy commissioner. So, Mr. Chairman, the concept for Anchorage and Fairbanks is not to provide for them how it's going to leave us if they leave. What we're going to promote is why is it good for the Army to stay? And so the concept of the training facilities that are out there, J-Park, the winter maneuvers, that the Arctic is the only area of operations in the United States of America. We are the Arctic nation for Alaska. And the support with the National Guard and the partnerships, close partnerships with our many, many agencies here in Alaska to help them, support them, do their missions, and provide great training opportunities for all of us to do the missions that we do is the strategy, if you will, to work with Anchorage and Fairbanks to promote Alaska as the premier state to stay in. Not just if you leave, bad things are going to happen, because they hear that all over the United States in those other states that they're looking at. But really highlighting the points of why is it good to be here. And I just want to add that for the record, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. One final before I go to the Judiciary Chair for questions and then other committee members is on slide 10, you talked about since 9/11, you know, the deployments that Alaska Guard was able to participate in. And so currently there's a movie out that talks about the fatigue of frequent deployments, American Sniper. Is that still a concern for the Guard? Is to address the issues with its members that have that kind of deployment fatigue?
At this point, we have no mandatory or directed deployments for units or individuals.
It's all. I'm talking about the past.
Yeah, it's all voluntary. Our strength grew while we were going through that cycle. Across the DOD, strength was down at the very beginning in the 2001 to 2005 era, because the military had been defunded so dramatically. Everybody was tired of sitting at home. There was no training money. There was no rotational exercise money. So strength was going like this. When that changed and they added bonuses and then we started getting an away fight, folks were coming to us in droves. We were turning them away. And the Alaska Army Guard, over the last 2 years, we went over 100% strength for the first time in my entire time here, because it was real folks. They weren't ghost guardsmen on the rolls but not coming to drill. We went over strength for the first time pretty much since I've been here. Now we've leveled off because our bonuses have been taken away. We've lost the deployments, so folks' motivation to come in so they can go to the away game is not there. But that's why we're evolving to the overseas exercise rotations, to give them something to go do outside of the U.S. to keep them involved and ready to go. The fatigue part, we've had a few of our units, our aviation units, a couple of them deployed 3 and 4 times, but we changed out a lot of the personnel on those. So no one person, unless they volunteered, went on more than 2 deployments over the last 13 years. And we did have about 100 overall that have 3 and 4 deployments under their belts. And they like it. It's a good paycheck. They get the combat experience, and it's an adrenaline rush, frankly. The fatigue deal that you saw in American Sniper, been there, done that. I saw that movie 3 days ago myself. It's pretty, it's overwhelming. But warriors want to be warriors to keep the bad guys away from our shores.
Thank you, General. Debbie, could you please note for the record that Representative Culver joined us at 158? And welcome. Madam Judiciary Chair, you have a question for the General?
Well, first of all, I want to begin by thanking the General and Deputy Commissioner O'Hare for coming here today, and also to let the General know that my office would certainly be interested in working with you to rewrite the military code to make it into a better and more workable document for all of us.
We are all for that, ma'am.
So we'll be in touch, or you be in touch, but yep. Somehow or other we need to get together and get together soon.
Yeah, we'll be spending quite a bit of time here in Juneau over the next several weeks, obviously, and we have done a lot of work. We brought in the senior legal advisors from National Guard Bureau. We brought in the legal teams from California and Arizona who went through their version of some of this trauma over the last few years, and they've brought in the best recommended model uniform code. We need to adjust it to Alaska's needs, because it's got to become Alaska's, and we want to do that in coordination with the governor's office and with the legislature to make it right for Alaska going forward.
Great. So, but besides that, I guess I'm wondering with one of the things that you said, that you want the ability to be able to prosecute within the Guard. If you'd had that ability before, would that have made a difference in these? If you had a situation where you had some bad actors, the ability particularly bad actors, you know, at the top. Would the ability to have prosecuted have made much of a difference?
Prosecution versus administrative discipline are two sort of different things, but they have some parallels. If you don't have a case to prosecute, because witnesses are afraid to come forward, or victims are afraid to come forward for whatever reasons, and it can be just embarrassment that they were put in a position to become a victim, you don't have anything to prosecute until you can put together a case to prove it and then do a prosecution. You've got to be able to get it to a grand jury level to be able to put the resources forward then and take it to a jury or a panel. A lot of folks in the past just were unwilling to come forward, either as victims or as somebody that had proof of an incident or an event, that it was solid enough to prosecute with civilian law enforcement. It's not going to be any different with a state military code to prosecute versus going to law enforcement, a DA's office, for example. It's got to be the same caseload ability to prove. A state military code or a state disciplinary regulation, you can still do discipline with about 51% because of violation of good order and discipline. That's where a state military code can be tremendously helpful, because then you're talking military good order and discipline of a militia member. But if they've convicted, or if somebody has committed a crime that's prosecutable under civil law, that's where it should go, because that's going to affect them the rest of their lives as a criminal. The military side, if we have a uniform military code and we have the federal military disciplinary regulations, that's going to take care of the military side of that individual who broke military good order and discipline. Putting the two together, I think, is where we really want to go and have a solid program and solid disciplinary control measures to keep our military members of the Alaska Militia on track, obey their oath of enlistment or commission, and when they break the rules, you appropriately discipline and or penalize them as a civilian citizen.
So in other words, in this rewrite, you don't want to actually, like, let's say that there's a rape.
Yep.
You don't want to actually prosecute for the rape. You'd send that to
I want the civil authorities of this state or the federal government to prosecute that. I want the teeth in my regs and in a state military code to ensure that their military career is properly affected because of that same thing.
So there was a movie a long time ago that was titled Conduct Unbecoming an Officer and a Gentleman. Mm-hmm. Is that still the standard, that sometimes conduct might not be prosecutable?
Not a crime, but they did something that violates why we exist as a profession. If I have an officer that's hanging out with a female subordinate's wife, that is a violation of good order and discipline. That's not a crime in the state of Alaska, but it's not right for a military member to violate that. And we don't have a code in the Guard in Alaska to deal with that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tuck, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that organizational chart, we show the Commissioner, the Adjutant General, Deputy Commissioner. And you're now the Acting Commissioner?
Yeah, the heritage title in all the states and Alaska, the Adjutant General, is the Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
And where were you in this just prior to taking this?
I was the Army National Guard Commander.
Army National Guard Commander?
Correct.
Okay. And when you said that there were insider attacks, predators from outside, you also mentioned that they joined our ranks.
Mm-hmm.
Did you mean that we had people that were from other states that came up here and joined our National Guard?
The ones that I'm primarily referring to is that batch of recruiters that have been the biggest attention getter, because that's where the majority of this came from. Not all, but the majority. They came to us from an active duty unit. They inter-service transferred from active duty into the Guard. And this was during the peak of the Alaska National Guard's deployments. So we had all kinds of vacancies. Our recruiters were deployed. They joined our recruiting team, and they set up shop and became predators.
And so this is something that just recently happened that...
It's a relatively modern phenomenon as far as that. And again, they all came from the same unit, from an active duty brigade, transitioned into the Guard, and they became a pack of wolves.
And then, you know, oftentimes we set statutes, and then we allow the governor and his administration to write the regulations.
Right.
When you say that we have no teeth in our military code, why weren't there some regulations written to put teeth into it? I mean, why do we have to wait for an outside investigation to determine that we need to clean our house in our military and veterans affairs?
Well, as again, the three-legged part of this, the regs, the Army regulations for personnel discipline, personnel actions, is one tool that's always been there. It's difficult and hard work, and a lot of people just didn't bother to take the time to use that for the control within the regulatory process of good order and discipline. It's, you have to do the whole thing. You still have to do the investigatory process. Then you have to apply the level of discipline based on the offense. And again, it can come start at a verbal warning to a letter of concern, all the way up to that ultimate, as I mentioned, other than honorable discharge. Our state has only ever had one full-time staff judge advocate officer for 20 years. That person was the first person I relieved back in September from duties for doing a poor job advising and supporting those disciplinary actions. And there were other gaps there.
Yeah. Just let me know when you have a follow-up question.
Okay, if I may, Mr. Chair, sorry. So, I mean, we look at our military as the way to do things right. And I just recently learned, I never knew this, that our National Guard's people are state employees. And so in many ways, I see this as a personnel management issue going forward, not saying that our military code of justice doesn't need improvement, but there's also regular management techniques that I believe have been overlooked. In reading that report, I'll tell you that I have a lot of questions. I don't want to take up a lot of time now, but Mr. Chair, I think that we should have another meeting to just discuss the elements of this report and some of the recommendations going forward. Because I didn't get a chance to go through some of the questions I have on just regular military and veterans affairs.
Right.
And I don't want to take up a lot of time on that, but I think the report is a really good read. When we talk about some of this stuff being recent, and then we talk about the equal opportunity employment, the report says that this goes back 10 years ago of not having accurate, I mean, it sounds like the problem is a cultural problem that started a long time ago that's just been recently been highlighted, maybe by a couple of recruiters. But it sounds like that we've been setting ourselves up for a situation like this for quite a while. And so I'd just like to, if we can, somewhere down the road, have another meeting just on that report.
Representative Tuck, is that, of course, this is a very important issue. It's going to take the legislature, not an individual committee, to address it, at least in the House, in preliminary conversations, is that the issue will be addressed by three committees, this committee, State Affairs and Judiciary, in the appropriate venues and the parts of it. So it is going to get a review, but it has to be in the responsibilities of each of those committees. Again, not one committee can fix this.
But on this committee, if we can at least, you know, have a report of the report, if you will, to go over so we know what actions that need to be taken from the legislature.
Yes, that I'll take into consideration. But again, it's going to take the legislature, not just one committee. And the two co-chairs, the two chairs on each side of me are going to be a part of that process, and those committee members as well. That's my intent. Yes.
Michael Harrigan, if I could add, if we get along those lines, Representative Tuck, looking at a report of the report, but I also would submit a report of the progress from the recommendations of those reports would be quite significant as well, sir.
And if I may, Chair, on one of those report of the progress, I have a little bit of concerns. The Working with law enforcement has supposed to been to protect people, not to expose people. And so I have a little bit of concerns when you're talking about we have this new position of the provost marshal, because that's still within the ranks. And what we're going to do is make sure that people have the opportunity to freely come forward. And I think that our investigations have been botched in freely coming forward, even with civilian police forces, because there's just been too much interaction. I can just tell you, cops don't like to investigate cops. And I will tell you that cops probably don't like to investigate National Guardsmen either. And so there's been a little bit too much collusion, not to make things right, but to cover things up. And so I'm going to be watching that really carefully.
Yes, and I would caution your comments as well. They should be hard charged, but we're not we're looking for solutions, not to other things. But I have a couple of people in the queue here. Yes, sir.
If I may, Mr. Chair, with this committee, the others, individual representatives and senators, I'm prepared to discuss some of the things that have occurred in the meantime, some of the corrective actions, so that you're not working from an assessment that was done back in the spring of last year to show some of the transitions of some of these key areas of concern and how we've set them up in the open so people can see how we're actually affecting those changes and corrections. And I'm bringing some of those folks here this week for face-to-face time with those who would like to speak with them and ask what they've done and what their role is in some of these activities that we're doing to make this right.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg, then Representative Lynn, and then Madam Chair, and then the last one that hasn't spoken yet. So we got questions all over the place here. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to thank you for having the first hearing of this committee this year looking at this particular issue. And I agree with you and the minority member both that that this is a major thing. And I had no idea that the three committees were going to be working together. Representative Lynn and I happen to be on all three, and then Representative Ledoux also on two of them. And I see, just from a management point of view, that this issue, and I'm just going to say dealing with the National Guard, is a little bit similar to the marijuana issue. We've got a bunch of committees working on various aspects, and I'm glad to see the leadership in this legislature working together to sort this thing out so that we can, in both instances, and I know I'm talking because several of us are involved in both of the issues, can work together and parse the thing out. In the time that I've served in the legislature, this is the first time we've taken a look at the National Guard. Starting in 85, when I first sat at this table, we have never done anything like this. In about the 15th or 16th state legislature, we formed this committee, the Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs, and Representative Ivan Ivan, who represented your district, and Tom Wright, who was his assistant, were the first folks who were involved in chairing this committee. And we set it up, and we visited various National Guard posts, and we went up in some of the plains and stuff, and it was very important for us to get the idea of who the Guard and the folks were. And we took a look at some of the emergency preparedness, and I helped on that effort to rewrite that part of Title 26. We have touched a little bit on the veterans issues, but not enough. And Mr. Chair, what I'm thinking, and I hope that maybe we can have some informal meetings and deal with this, is that we look at the entire department and see what legislative assistance we can provide, and not just on the National Guard, but on the way the department is organized, the concept of civilian control of the military and stuff. I think it's going to be helpful to have to have that looked at as well. Whether we have enough people in that little office of Veterans Affairs to serve the huge veteran population of this state, who are largely becoming senior citizens now with much greater need. And I think, and this has nothing to do with the National Guard particularly, but it has everything to do with the department, we need to be sure that we have the facilities to serve those people who are going into senior status and who've been veterans and who are going to need additional things. And I've talked with the chair of the State Affairs Committee on the issue of focusing this legislature a little bit on the issues of aging, special subcommittees on aging or something like that. And this is something that can deal with the veterans' issues here. The issue of downsizing of the bases. And the question, just, I had a staffer or somebody talking to me today, why we don't maybe with the opening of the Arctic have a Navy squadron based somewhere at Kodiak or something like that. We looked at that in the 1980s. And we have lots, and in your area on the Arctic policy and stuff, this is all, as we say, a seamless web. And I'm glad that you're taking the leadership role, Representative Herron, in this. And it goes beyond the National Guard, and it's got to be a very positive thing. It's going to take all of us. But I hope that we follow through, and I hope I'm not speaking on behalf of my minority leader here, that this becomes a bipartisan effort to try to resolve this. And it's, frankly, no accident that the two of us volunteered for this committee.
Thank you for your kind remarks. I, as a Marine, I prefer military over pot any day. Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation, General. The governor has appointed, I don't know the exact title, a special investigator.
Right.
Is that the title?
Special investigator.
Yeah. And has she already
started? I talked to her on the phone the evening of the announcement. I was in Little Rock with the other adjutants general, and we already had our opening. Here's who my folks are, and here's how to get hold of them. I'll be meeting with her later this week.
Okay, fine. So the investigation is underway at this point, correct?
Just this week, yes, sir.
Does she have any guesstimate or wag on how long it will take?
Our generic understanding is sometime this spring, April, for an initial report or a primary report.
That will be before we adjourn this session?
I don't believe so, sir.
Okay. That's the thing that concerns me because, as I understand it, the whole point of having a special investigator, and I support that, by the way, is to determine the facts.
Right.
And so how can we make policy in the three main committees here and to have access to the facts? Because I don't know, at least speaking for my own committee, we don't have the assets to do the kind of investigation that this special investigator does. So she's going to determine the facts, probably make recommendations, I would assume. So how can we get ahead of the train here and make good new policy, perhaps new legislation, when you don't have all the facts?
Well, we already have the OCI assessment with its recommendations, which you've all been given free access to. Again, not being an elected official or kind of knowing some of the inner workings, one of the ways might be for the chair of the committee to meet with the governor and see about sharing things as the investigator is moving along, progress reports, something along those lines.
Well, maybe Mr. Chair,
I'll be showing, you know, our opening the drawers and providing everything that the OCI assessment team got access to that investigator as the commissioner and the military leader at the moment. And as far as showing what that is, the governor is the one who's assigned that investigator. So working for the governor as one of his commissioners, I have to use that track, but that would be a possible avenue to provide the legislature with that information.
To respond to that through the chair, Representative Lynn, and the commissioners, my job is for continuity in the department, as well as to make sure that the recommendations of this OCI investigation are being moved forward. So there will be the governor's special investigation going on to determine what went right, what went wrong, and historical, if you will. Our job is to move forward on the OCI investigation's recommendations for improvement, as well as to build a good team, rebuild a good team.
Yes. Representative Lynn, basically we want them to keep the doors open, want them to do their duties as assigned. The legislature is going to have, in my opinion, is going to have to walk carefully. We don't want to injure the investigation or re-injure the victims. And so we do have a two-year cycle here. It's taken 20, 30 years to get to this point, and we shouldn't rush to fix something that needs fixing. We need to do it correctly.
Mr. Chair, that was exactly my point. We have all these investigations going on. We had the opening, I guess, investigation. I don't know who did this when it all came to light. And now we've got the special investigator. Sorry, and did you say the OSI?
OCI, Office of Complex Investigations.
OCI, I thought you said OSI.
That is a brand new thing, too, by the way, sir. National Guard Bureau, again, because this was a DOD-wide thing, the sexual assault exposure and finally opening that book. The National Guard Bureau, the Title 10 headquarters for us, provided and pulled in folks from around the country and created assessment teams to go and look at sexual assault specific or EO/EEO related things in a state and several others, and we were the third state to receive kind of that process. Arizona was the most recent, and they come in and then with that assessment show areas that need worked on, and here's what we recommend as the way to work on those based on their subject matter experts on the team. And in this case, Governor Parnell requested that assessment. They came in, did the initial assessment, briefed him back, and he gave the community that packet. And then the transition happened, and that team came in and briefed the new governor and administration. Here's where they're at today. And that just happened in early December. So Governor Walker and his team received that back brief from the OCI follow-on support team and the National Guard Bureau Vice Chief, the three-star. And that just occurred in December, and here's what Alaska's done in the meantime. They're doing pretty good here, here, and here. They still need some work to do here. The command climate thing will take longer, because it will, for everybody to feel comfortable in the ranks all the time about how we operate. So that's our work forward, and that's where we've built our teams within the Alaska National Guard, the functional development and improvement teams, so that we own our fix.
I want to thank you for your response. And I'm just concerned, that all the different investigating groups,
yes,
kind of identify the same facts.
We have been investigated infinitum over the last year, and the facts are the facts. They're not really going to change. They'll evolve as we deal with disciplinary things or corrective actions and processes.
And will, if I may, will the, what's your title, special investigator?
Special investigator.
Will she be also investigating local law enforcement?
I think that's one of the program areas of concern. So, I've already introduced her to our new Provost Marshal team, for example. She's going to go in there and then see what those new linkages and agreements are that we've made with law enforcement from the Department of Law and Attorney General's office all the way to the local level.
Fine. Again, I don't want to take up too much time. I'm very concerned that we do something in the legislature, some kind of legislation or something, before we have all the facts, and we have to depend on one set of facts before we can make an intelligent.
Right. And again, we're about to take a leap as a state from a 1955 territorial code to something of use for the 21st century for the Alaska National Guard and DMVA. So let's get it as right as we can. And again, we've got some great models from other states who've gone through this. So if we take a really good one or two of those, tweak it to Alaska's purposes, then you guys can act on it, turn it into proper legislation for our state.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. We don't need investigator to develop good leadership is what we need here.
Yes, sir. And Mr. Chairman, we are certainly willing to work with the committee to come up with some good products. And we've offered Judge Trish Collins every resource the department has to have a thorough investigation. And we look forward to making better the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me.
Okay, we have two left in the queue. Representative Ledoux.
Two questions here. First is a relatively easy one. Does the special investigator have subpoena power?
I'm not sure, ma'am.
Because if she doesn't, there's really not any way to force people to talk to her.
I don't know what authorities that she's been granted under. I think she was hired as a contractor.
Right.
I know she's working directly with the Attorney General's office, and they certainly have the powers available to them. But I can't answer that directly, ma'am.
All right. Well, we'll
wait on the answer.
Yes.
Ted, make it a phone call.
Okay. Secondly, under military law or National Guard law, or if somebody knows that something wrong is going on, is there any obligation to report it up to someone? I remember back when the dinosaurs were roaming the earth, a bunch of people in the Air Force Academy, cadets, got expelled because there was a cheating scandal. And they did not report on their colleagues, their fellow cadets who had been cheating, and that was a violation of at least the Colorado Military Academies.
I will not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate those who do. That's the code of the federal academies. That's the same code that I had with Federal Officer Candidate School, to train to be an officer. The oath of enlistment, the oath of commission that every service member takes, enlisted or officer, the obligation is all-inclusive, that you can't force somebody to go and say something that they just may not want to do. Now, we locally, as part of our recovery programs here, I've directed a policy memo that is, if a member of the Alaska National Guard has done something out in the civilian community that's a violation of law, they're required to self-report to their military chain of command, because what they've done can and may violate their military obligations. So I can't make them do it. I don't have force of law, and I can't reach into somebody's brain and know what they know, but at least we have a specified policy that makes them obligated to that. We didn't have that before. There's no such thing as self-report without that.
But again, what about reporting on somebody else?
Same thing. It's up to an individual whether they're going to report a crime or not. It's just like watching somebody get beat on a street corner, ma'am. Are you going to step in and, you know, potentially put yourself at physical harm or risk, or are you just going to take a snapshot photo with your cell phone and move on?
So the military doesn't. I realize under civilian rule,
right?
That's not required under civilian law. Mm-hmm. So. Other than in the military academies, is that what you're telling me, that the military does not require?
It's inherent in the oath of service that we take as military personnel and professionals, but there is not, you can't force somebody to say anything.
Well, but if you find, can I follow up?
Yes.
But if you find out that somebody
knew and report
and did not report, then that is
then using the military good order and discipline regulations and guidance and potentially a uniform code of military justice, we might be able to penalize that person or discipline that person for failure to act, I think is the term.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
Would you be able to do that retroactively? So suppose we amended this military code, and suppose we find out through the investigation that there were a number of And it would probably be of the officer corps as opposed to the enlisted people, that there were a number of people who knew what was going on and didn't say anything. Would we be able to do anything?
Ma'am, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't write legislation. You know, I don't know. And then you're going to go back to the beginning of humankind and penalize everybody eventually.
Okay, that's stretch that conversation. Representative Culver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. A couple of comments. I agree with the chairman that we need to let the special investigator prepare the report, and based on the recommendations of the report, then I think probably during the interim it would probably be appropriate for the committee to start kicking around options for next session. I'll leave it at the will of the chair how he wants to handle that. As a representative for Fort Greely, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, I want to recognize the importance of the Alaska Army Guard and the base fabric of Fort Greely and the supporting the 49th Ground Missile Defense Battalion provides the support at Fort Greely, and it's we're real proud to have you there for our national defense. You know, Mr. Chairman, perhaps the committee would be interested in getting a tour this summer. I just had a meeting with a Boeing government affairs official and invited us to come out. They've had other the committee's been there in the past, and they're expanding this summer up to 44 silos. And so if during the summertime, perhaps I can help facilitate if the committee wishes or the chairman wishes to go out there and see how our guards interacting with the national and missile defense mission.
They're one of our nation's most visited operational units, and with the preparation, we can definitely facilitate and assist in that visit as well.
Well, we'll defer to our chair if he so desires us to.
I think it's an excellent idea. It's integral to national security, and so I think it's important. I think we'll take one more question, comment, and then we'll close for the day.
Okay,
go ahead, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that the OCI report has some really good, alarming facts in that with some really excellent recommendations. I'm glad that the National Guard isn't waiting for another investigation before taking action, because there are great recommendations and action that can be taken now. I believe that this special investigation is more of who may have violated the law more than it is trying to get down to the facts. So if you want to look at the OCI report, it's very good. I think it's a good foundation for us to know what direction that we need to go. And to wait to the interim, I think, is really putting things off to the side. We have people that we need to restore trust in our Guard once again. And I think quick, swift action is a good way of doing it. Again, thanks for starting off with making the recommendation corrections necessary right off the bat. And I'll just, in talking about culture, I watched this program, and they had these monkeys that were all in a cage. And the cage had some wires connected to it so that whenever one monkey reached for a banana, they all got shocked. And in reaching for that banana, they'd all get shocked. And so anytime they did it repeatedly, so anytime that any one monkey went for that banana, the rest of the monkeys would jump on that monkey to stop him from reaching for that banana. Mm-hmm. And then they slowly replaced monkeys out of the cage one by one, and that new monkey, of course, went for the banana, and the rest of them jumped on that monkey. To eventually, without shocking any more monkeys, they changed out all the monkeys, and the culture of those monkeys were continually to beat up the one monkey, the new monkey coming in grabbing that banana. And so things don't change overnight, but by taking swift action, things may change. And so so I want to thank you guys for taking the swift action that you have so far.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's been an hour and a half. General, Deputy Commissioner, appreciate your Fort Rightness. You've taken the issue dead on. It's not going to be easy, but it appears to this committee member and to the others that you're going in the right direction. So the conversation will not end. We'll just suspend it for now, and then Sir. We'll meet again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So at 2:35, this committee is adjourned.